to help me with something. So two of our volunteers, Christiani and Itzi, found something on the steps today. The steps going up to lunch. And they thought, oh, someone has obviously dropped this. And they put it on the ledge near the steps. And later they went past and it was on the ground again. And so they picked it up and they thought, oh, well, maybe we'll take it downstairs and we'll see, you know, we'll bring it to the conference office. And maybe someone will ask about it. What it was this.
Da-da-da-dong. So I will read the notes in French. Comment habiter par mon regard l'espoir vécu d'un cinéaste et de son personnage, le lieu réel d'un film? Point d'interrogation. Nobody understands French, that's a problem.
So could you give us a description of this?
How could you live in a gaze of hope of a cineast, a character, a place, a real place of a film? It's really bizarre in French too.
So if anyone's trying to make a declaration of love in poetic French, I have it. You can pick it up from me later. Or maybe it was meant for me. That's my favorite brand, actually.
Can we start with the film?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Our program.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. We're going to start with the final event of our ARMS conference 2019 in Berlin. My name's Benno, and it's a great pleasure to be here and to kind of guide you through these 2 hours together with Kate, who most of you, I'm sure, have met already. And let me start by saying welcome, and you have been and you are a fantastic audience. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here. And, you know, what we are trying to do in this closing event, we try to take stock, not of everything that has been said, but about kind of the main topics, maybe the main challenges, the main potentials we have been discussing over the last 3 days. And we will try to look towards the future. What is ahead of us? Where are we going to go? In practical terms, in organizational terms, but also in political terms. That is kind of what we...
Hello.
what we're going to do now, and Kate is going to explain to you how we're going to do it.
Not yet. So we put out, we received an expression of interest to host the next ALMS, and we decided that we should put the call out to see if anyone else might be interested. Just a little explanation. Right now we're going to hear from a couple of people who are thinking about maybe putting their names forward to host the next one. There is no decision-making process. The ALMS conference series is a grassroots organic process. So usually it just sort of somehow happens that someone volunteers to do the next one. Some things to maybe think about for the future are, as you know, I've emailed with a lot of the presenters, but for the participants as well, we receive such a flood of abstracts. And this conference just shows, I mean, everyone's been talking about how big it is and, you know, that it's, some people have actually found it a little bit overwhelming, which I can fully appreciate and understand. But it might be worth thinking about in the future because the field has developed so much. It might be worth thinking about things like maybe having intervals where we have an international conference once every so few years And then in between, people could organise themselves into regional conferences. So that would be something perhaps that people could think about in the future. But for now, we had three expressions of interest, one from Bergen, one from Toronto, and one from San Francisco. So I'd like to offer these people who have expressed interest to come up onto the stage, and I'll give them 2 or 3 minutes to introduce themselves. But we're not going to, we don't make any decision about who hosts the next one. It will be up to these people to talk to one another, and maybe there will be other expressions of interest that come out over the next month. So I'd like to introduce or invite Torna Hellesund, Regan Swanson from the Archives, if she's in the room, and Terry Beswick from San Francisco. I'll give you a wave.
So we'll start with the tiniest alternative, which is the city of Bergen in Norway. And my name is Torna Hellesund. I'm a professor of cultural history at the University of Bergen, and I'm also heavily affiliated with the Queer Archive in Norway, which is located at the University of Bergen. So the Queer Archive would love to welcome you to Bergen in 2022. If that would be of interest. And the reason why 2022 is the alternative for Bergen is that 2022 is the 50th anniversary of the decriminalization of male homosexuality in Norway, and the Queer Archive has pushed for the government to kind of recognize this anniversary, and the Minister of Culture just declared 2022 as a queer cultural year in Norway. So 2022 that would be a year where we probably could get funding to host a fantastic conference like this. So that's an alternative. Bergen is extremely much smaller than Berlin. It's also cooler, but it's also more expensive. So that's one alternative on the kind of periphery of Europe, if that would be of interest, and then there are other great cities. So please.
Hi, everyone. First, I just want to say thank you, as long as I have the opportunity, for a wonderful conference. This has been a great honor to participate in this with all of you. My name is Terry Beswick, and I'm the executive director of the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco. We were founded in 1985. We are one of the largest archives of queer history in the world, certainly one of the largest independent community-based archives. We're unaffiliated with any major institution. We have an archives in the mid-market area of San Francisco. I hope, how many people have been to visit us? How many people want to? No. So we'd love to have you there. We also have a museum in the Castro neighborhood of San Francisco. It's too small, unfortunately. We're very proud of it, and we get tens of thousands of visitors every year from around the world. And we try to tell the history of San Francisco in 1,200 square feet. So one of our big projects right now, and one of my big hesitations, frankly, for offering to host this conference is that we are trying to build a full-scale museum of queer history in San Francisco, and as are many other cities around the world, and I really wish we had more opportunities to talk about that. And I think, though, that the Historical Society, so we've been involved. Recently we co-hosted the Queer History Conference with the Committee on LGBT History at San Francisco State University. We've collaborated with a lot of organizations, and I don't come to you with a full proposal or a set of collaborating organizations that have agreed on a particular date or locations in San Francisco, but we have collaborated with the universities in San Francisco. Of course, it's a university town, on major projects like the AIDS History Project with UCSF and the San Francisco Public Library. I'm almost done. So So really, I come up here tonight just to talk to you about our desire to play a role in hosting a future conference, and I don't have a specific date, but I think probably talking with Kate, I think we agreed that we want to come together with the other potential host cities and have a conversation about, you know, how frequently do we want to host this conference and the regional versus international idea. We kind of felt like 2 years is a little scary for us right now to do it in 2 years, and yet I would love to see this happen within 2 years internationally again, and so I feel a responsibility to facilitate that if possible. And funding is a big question. This is a bit of an odd conference because there isn't an ongoing structure or organization. And so there's no funding attached to it necessarily, but I think that there are potential sponsors that could be carried forward and certainly some that we've worked with in San Francisco. So thank you very much, and we'll talk more.
Excellent. And the Canadian representative, please come out on the stage.
Hello, my name is Don McLeod. I'm a longtime volunteer with the archives in Toronto. Unfortunately, Reagan wasn't able to be here, so I can just speak very briefly on this. I know that we were contemplating offering our name for the conference for 2023, which will be our 50th anniversary. So we're hoping to host it and to maybe partner with other groups that are related to us in some way. For example, the Mark S. Bonham Center at the University of Toronto, which is a large gay institution there where people can take everything from bachelor's degrees to PhDs in queer studies. Also probably with the library school, they have a gay component there too. So this is all very tentative, but we wanted to put our name forward, and we hope to see you in Toronto.
So thank you very much. Three wonderful bits. It's great to have choice. And at the same time, I think this should not be feel like the International Olympic Committee making a decision on where the next event is going to take place. So really, as Kate said, this is the beginning of a discussion. You should all be involved in this discussion. And it's, you know, everything is open for question. Is it going to be 21, 22, 23, 24? Which place is going to be? Is there, you know, can arms conferences change in size so they can be accommodated by, you know, all the other possible places where people would wish to organize a congregation like this. So really, this is the beginning of a discussion, and I look forward to what will come out of this discussion. Now, I'm going to quickly explain what's going to happen next. We thought out a little bit of a choreography for this panel. The idea is that Kate and I will ask one of the panelists, who will be introduced in a second, one question. Then there is an answer to the question, and then another panelist will be asked to react to that answer, to kind of start already from the very beginning conversation on stage. And after we have done that five times, then we will open up for questions from the audience. Six times. I've never been good with numbers, sorry. Then we will open up to questions for questions from the audience, and after that we will, enter in the grandeur of the real, very final closing ceremonies. And with that, I hand over to Kate, and you can introduce. I didn't think so.
No. Should I?
If you want to. In any case, I'll hand over to you, and...
Well, the title of this session, thank you very much, Benno, the title of this session is Queering Memory, Defending the Future. So just a little explanation about this, because I think it's important to sort of set up the conversation. So this is an opportunity, obviously, for the conference as a whole to consider the discussions over the previous 3 days, take stock of the current landscape, and celebrate and acknowledge our achievements so far, but most importantly, to identify key challenges going forward. So we've curated the panel of six speakers from a range of countries and institutional contexts, east, west, north, south, to represent the work currently being done to address significant gaps and provide models for future work in queer alms, but also to speak about the challenges posed by increasingly homo and transphobic strongman governments to the future of queering memory. We hope through the combination of speakers to unpack some old stereotypes, and the discussion will be explicitly political. We hope to identify the key challenges facing not only queer alms, but also queer lives, and contribute towards a sense of global solidarity for the future. So this is the framework of the discussion. So first of all, I'm going to just basically say who the speakers are, and I'll say where they're from, and then we will launch into the discussion. So first of all, we invite Pia Laskar, who is from the Swedish National Historical Museums in Stockholm, Leonardo da Silva from the Museum of Sexual Diversity in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Jonathan Katz from the Harvey Milk Institute, and he's a guest professor at the University of Pennsylvania at the moment, Judith Takash from the Center for Social Sciences and the Hungarian Academy of Sciences in Budapest, Hungary, Aaron Devor from the Transgender Archives and Chair in Transgender Studies, University of Victoria, Canada, and Katya Suvarina from the Public History Laboratory and the Garage Museum of Contemporary Art in Moscow. So this is the combination of speakers we have on the stage. So I'd like to start by asking Pia from Sweden, thinking about queer interventions in the public museum sector in Sweden, what kind of impact are these interventions aiming towards, and how should such interventions be formulated in Sweden and elsewhere?
Thank you for inviting me, first of all, to this panel. And I would also like to take the opportunity to thank my fellow colleagues in the Queer Movements Archive and Library in Gothenburg, who is here today, for we have had interesting discussions about this question during the lunch today. So thank you, guys. I think the most important queer intervention is to question the heteronormative narrative that prevails in museums in Sweden and elsewhere. And please do not mistake heteronormative with heterodominance, because that is two different things. Like adding queers of different sorts to an always already heterosexual or gender anachronistic past is not enough. Instead, I think that museums and collectors need to describe and contextualize how sexuality and gender ideals and norms have been established, and how ruptures of these ideals have looked like and been described. To collect traces of ruptures is about collecting traces of queerness and frictions, to show how people in all kinds of contexts have strived to move through or around regulations of sexual behaviors and gender ideals in any times and cultures. The latter is important for to give perspectives on identity politics. It is also important to it's also important that the entire museum takes part in the processes of changing the marginalizations of certain groups for to build a more inclusive museum. However, changing, as we know, is a complicated and troubling process. Therefore, we need to have a mature museum directory that can handle frictions. Crises are good and beneficial. And we have to understand that, and we also need museum directors and communicators that stands behind challenging exhibitions, curators, artists, and researchers, and that they do that publicly. This is especially important in times of heated debates and alternative facts. And in the shadow of that, the museums and we as queers, wherever we are, need to be very proactive to get our message out publicly. And it's also, therefore, crucial to work with scholars in the edge of the fields the research fields that are dealing with sexualities and gender. We need to have a firm ground to stand on when we are combating attacks from alternative fact producers. And for the third, on a structural level, I think it's really important to have thought through recruitment policy. The museums need to recruit queers with diverse experiences, because however tempting and seducing it is that we all call ourselves a family, we are very different when it comes to economical resources or language resources or whatever resources. It's class differences and it's a lot of intersectional differences between us. So the intersections of queers must be mirrored by the staff of museums and archives. Everything else is marginalization, I think. We could use an accepted word to describe this. It's everything else is discrimination. Thank you. We have just a very few moments, you know, to speak, so we need intersectional experiences to be able to pose and answer relevant questions. It cannot be left to the white middle class, straight or not, in museums. It also goes for this arms conference. We're asked to be radical and so. It goes for this arms conference as well. It's overwhelmingly fantastic in many ways, but it's very white and small, non-funded archives or collectors wasn't able to participate. Perhaps they didn't even feel interpelled by the announcements for the conference. Many of us here collects activists' stuff, and yet the activists can't participate in the sessions of economical reasons. Queer archives needs activists to get input on collecting, preserving, and accessing data and artifacts. So I think ALMS organizers need to find ways to invite activists and queer people in the cultural heritage sector that cannot afford to come here. And how this shall be done, that's up for discussion. But we need activists to be able to push and work for change wherever we are. So that's what I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'd like to...
Thank you very much, Pia. I'm thinking this is really good theoretical, methodological plan, which leads us to... I'm sorry, gender equality, and I'm just I don't want to spend these 3 minutes in order to describe that we can put it into Russian situation because we are way beyond, we find the past and we have a really difficult situation in this kind of the concerning queer and public sphere. But I really want to ask you if you have any particular example of such kind of the work. I mean, like any connected with any ideas that you've just told us, which is happening in Sweden right now.
Yeah. What happens in Sweden right now? Well, you know, I don't think, I mean, it's very big differences between Russia and Sweden, of course, and Trump land and Sweden and many. But I think that where there is a space for oppression, there is also space for resistance. And I know that Nat here from St. Petersburg, where are you? I learned a lot from you and your group in St. Petersburg. When Putin said that queers are animals, what did you do? You went out on the street and dressed as animals and asked for animal liberations. So you can do many things. So... And it's a lot of hate, and we live in fear of Swedish Democrats, the nationalist extreme party in Sweden, to come into the position of governing. But we have to take a lot of... we are thinking about a lot of strategies to combat that. But I think it's very, very important also that communication... that we communicate our... sound perspectives, because they are sound, and that we defend them in the public to whatever costs, and that we work very, very closely with the universities and radical curators and museum professionals, and they will not be able to beat us. Thank you.
Okay, that took us already right into whatever the heart of the matter, I guess. The next question is for Leonardo. And it is, what do you think were the most important factors that enabled you and your colleagues to set up the Museum for Sexual Diversity in Sao Paulo in 2012? And what are some of the challenges you faced in doing that? And at the same time, second part of the question, looking at the current political situation in Brazil, what are its future prospects, the future prospects of the museum?
Okay, thank you. I'm a little bit nervous. I don't speak English very well, but I will try. So I think that some facts that's important, one of them in São Paulo, it's the existence of the biggest pride parade in the world, with the records that reached 4.5 million of people on the street, making it difficult for public policy not to see itself as the popular expression of manifestation. It is also the second event that attracts more tourists to the city, and what it can profit more. And inside the public policy of Brazil, progressive governments create instances of representation for the LGBTIQ population that would guide some of the public policies in the regions. In São Paulo, for example, LGBTIQ representation bodies were created as a national representative council for this theme in the last times in Brazil. Since there was a demand from the social movement that began in the 90s for the Museum of Sexual Diversity, it ended up being contemplated and impelled through the coordination of sexual diversity in the state. But politics in Brazil has become very complicated and sui generis milestones. In our country, treating public politics often as a propaganda speech. So, yes, we have a Museum of Sexual Diversity, which does activities every week, which always tries to diversify our products, be dynamic, and above all, talk to the LGBT community in São Paulo city. On the other hand, public police does not give us the due attention. The museum, in the priority of the governmental serves the majority of the political advertisement of the part of situation in São Paulo to say, yes, we have diversity police on the subject and for the political advertising when necessary. However, even Trout is one of the museums with the lowest financial resources in this country. We have been able to produce a lot, make important exhibitions, which would often cost an exorbitant amount for any other Brazilian institutions. However, from networks of solidarity that understand the situation and the importance of the space, coming in the opposite direction of Brazilian politics, in which much is expanded for some results that are obtained mainly in the upper collections of the government. And the second question, I think, is the most important question because the scenario of Brazil lives today, and it's a little bit dramatic. It's a difficult to see good perspectives in Brazil today. The country elected in 2018 a candidate declared against our existence. His election also leveraged a series of hate speech by the population and the violence to space of LGBTIQ resistance and to our population has increased. Sometimes Jair Bolsonaro says that he is proud to be homophobic. So it's obvious. We have not received any direct threat from the current federal government in the field of public police. For now, the opposition occupies the field of hate speech to our population, and we see the Federal Supreme Court and other instances of maximum representation acting to safeguard and protect some more of our rights, which is a good thing. However, we cannot count with the luck, the moralism that intensifies in our country, answering a very large portion of Brazilian society, with some institutional echoes, for example, to censor the Queer Museum exhibition in 2017, an action that had not happened since the Brazilian military dictatorship that stifled our democracy. Brazilian democracy goes bad. One of the signs of this is that 15 months ago, our counselor, Marielle Franco, was murdered. Was a lesbian and also defended our guidance in the legislative chamber of Rio de Janeiro. 15 months ago, we do not have institutional answers about who murdered Marielle Franco. Although several evidence that links with the son of the current president with the murder. Recently, one of Brazil's best elected deputies, Jean Willis, the first LGBTIQ activist in Congress, had to exonerate and exile to Europe because they needed to be escorted 15 hours per day for fear of losing his life and as well as Marielle Franco, both of the same opposition party. So in the field of discourse and confrontation in parliaments, some of LGBT leaders need to isolate themselves or be killed by a state that after a short period of democracy returns with the most cruel and corruptive faces possible, and worst of all, being applauded by a large part of the population. One more example that Brazil democracy is sick is the prison of the most popular political in our country without evidence of crimes. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was elected because he led the ballot measures with a very great distance from the other candidates. But he cannot run for the presidency being arrested shortly before the elections without evidence of the crimes accused. And the main structures of Brazil corroborate for its impossibility to elect. So the Brazilian democracy has been living constant blows since the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff in 2016. And it's a complicated scenario for Brazilian population, especially for the most vulnerable populations. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Leonardo. And now we wanted to ask Aaron Dever to add to that, extend on that, or for your comment on this.
I'd like to start, Leonardo, to commend you and your colleagues for your bravery in the face of extremely hard to imagine opposition. To have tasted some freedom, some democracy, and to have it pulled out from under you in such a dramatic, as you say, and horrible way. To live under the conditions that you must face takes huge bravery. So I share the applause of everyone else. And I ask you, you have here gathered several hundred people who care very much about the situation in Brazil. What can we do from a distance to help make your task a little bit more successful?
I think all of you can to be pressure in our countries, in our communities, and talk about the situation of Brazil, leave it, and talk about the case of Marielle Franco, of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, that make a part of the same system and make a part of the same planning for Brazil. So I think you can reply it and to take these things, to take the discourses, to take the solidarity and to go to our countries and share the solidarity, share the pressure to our government. And you know, it's really hard to live in Brazil because we was living in a little bit good situation in the last 13 years. You know, democracy is maybe a possible in that time, but now it's we have a horrible scenario. So if you can to share our histories, can to share depression in your countries to make maybe international pressure to this, it's really good for us to take and to talk about the murder of Marielle Franco. It's so really important to talk about the prison of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. It's so really important in all of the world. And I think it's the most important thing is to have a international pressure to do this. So I think that, sorry for my English.
Thank you.
So we will move from Bolsonaro land to Trump land, as Pia said before. And I'd like to pose the next question to Jonathan Katz. And slightly maybe shifting focus a little bit. So dwelling upon the link between art and queer memory, how can artistic practices, past, present and future, engender visibility of queer lives and perhaps engender some of the solidarity that Leonardo has talked about? And how might your take on this be shaped by the specific context of Trumpland?
I think it's important, and I'm going to say this as a parenthesis that governs everything I'm about to say, to keep utopian prospects and utopian proposals alive, especially in these darkening times. They help to orient us, and that's what I'm going to do tonight. We can only answer the questions we ask, and the form of those questions determines their answers. So not surprisingly, when we look for historical instances of lesbian, gay, or trans identity as we understand them, we always find them. But the great thing about images is that they bleed. By that I mean they exceed the words we have, either because they have shades of meaning that language can't yet speak, or because they depict things that articulate ideas and languages that violate social norms and laws. Language, after all, is leaden. It drags with it its complicated and painful social histories wherever it goes. And language, after all, is addressed to every speaker, presuming a kind of equal competency. But images speak to different folks differentially, with different competencies, some of whom can and do see things that other people don't. We, as queer people, know this. Or if they do see them, they don't admit to seeing them, right, because that would reveal too much. The great commonplace that in art each sees what they want to see is art's greatest strength. When the Russian surrealist Pavel Chelyachev painted a large erect penis in the center of the painting Hide Seek, one of the centerpieces at the Museum of Modern Art, few people consciously saw it. Indeed, when I published something about it recently, it was vigorously contested. But Chelyachev's own notes point to the existence of this image, as does the fact that the painting is called Hide and Seek. And that painting, right, was voted the number one most popular modern painting in America in 1948. So what's the relationship between an erotics you can't see, but perhaps feel, and popularity in art? In her 1964 text, queer writer and theorist Susan Sontag wrote the following. In place of a hermeneutics, we need an erotics of art. End quote. Sontag was pointing to the way images can bypass the conscious mind and work over our feelings, allowing access to regions we have long suppressed or sublimated. Art is dangerous because it activates feeling, and feeling is unruly. It doesn't adhere to our own self-understandings, our rules or taxonomies for dividing up and making sense of the world. Art is, in short, queer, or better said, even, trans. Transgender and transsexual, to be sure, but trans in the larger metaphorical sense of crossing every border, contaminating every purity. And because it freely crosses our policed borders, it articulates in so doing what words can't. And it can represent even what's not yet here, what's not yet formulated, inchoate visions of a world to come, inklings of feeling that are too premature to concretize into words. No surprise, then, that I've long argued that art is the largest queer archive in the world, if only we knew how to look at it, without the preordained notions of what we expect to find. And if, as I hope, we all agree that the old minoritizing vision of sexual differences are finally coming under pressure, then we should expect to find evidence of this transness everywhere, perhaps most importantly in the work of artists who are in fact inclined to the opposite sex. Let's think about, for example, that great old badass, the British founder of pop art, Richard Hamilton, who once wrote, quote, "The pop fine art standpoint is fundamentally a statement of belief in the changing values of society. Pop art is a profession of approbation of mass culture. It is positive Dada, creative where Dada was destructive." Well, perhaps not Dada, he continues. Perhaps it's Mama, end quote. For a straight male artist to align himself with Mama, with a female protean force, is in itself, of course, striking. And it speaks to Hamilton's cultivation of a trans or queer play with duality, his embrace of a positive Dada committed to a non-hierarchical relation among categories. Another example. The Brazilian artist Lygia Clark organized a performance in 1970 called Anthropophagic Drool. The title is a play on the idea of cannibalism, which was itself a play with racist tropes around Brazil that the great early 20th century Brazilian writer Andrade first re-articulated in a positive way as Brazil consuming other cultures towards the achievement of its own unique hybridity. In the performance, people kneel on the ground around a prostrate figure lying between them while pulling threads of right wet thread out of their mouth and covering the figure with these wet threads. Like a continuous, vomiting up of what's inside them, they entomb that figure in the wet threads only in the end of the performance to help free the figure in a birth-like act. The piece speaks to a form of sociality that has no name yet, one in which we give the other what we are as a womb only to enable them to break free of it. We are encased in the other, but ourselves, deeply touched but autonomous. It is, in short, the opposite of cannibalism, the consumption of the other, in favor of a new relationship of generosity and acknowledgement, a utopian rebirth. When another
Jonathan,
Brazilian...
I have to ask you to...
Wrap it up. It's just one more paragraph. When another Brazilian queer artist, Elio Oiticica, made his installation Tropicália in 1966, he asked visitors to take off their shoes and walk barefoot through a series of rooms. They moved through warm sand, smooth pebbles, water, sleek plastic, straw floors, while fans blew air, flowers bloomed, plants brushed the skin, a cockatoo spoke, a TV blasted, and then a radio. Some were colorful rooms, others were lined with mirrors, some you had to feel your way through. Touch, sight, sound, even smell were directly invoked and seduced and activated. Art was relocated from the brain back into the body, into the complex sensorium of our total being. Oiticica wanted to speak to our common embodiment, to elevate the simple truth that we all experience the world through our bodies. But this is a politics, to be sure, an ideology that grounds the claim of equality on the simple yet profound truth that all of us feel, even if we feel differently. That's the queerest queer liberation I can imagine.
Thank you. And I'd like to invite Leonardo to react to this contribution, particularly the Brazilian art focus.
Sorry, can I?
You can. Would you like to say something in response to Jonathan's contribution or ask a question?
But I think I don't. I'm desiring this.
That's okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. For those remarks on the utopian potential of trans art. And now we move from the United States and Jonathan to Judith and Hungary. And thinking about the Hungarian context, one of the questions we wanted to pose to you is, what difference does it make whether official institutions, governments, deliberately support the public commemoration of queer history, or whether these official institutions decide not to support these kinds of commemorations? There is a widespread assumption that things are much better in the West than they are in non-Western countries. And we would really like to ask you, can you comment on those assumptions?
Well, I will try to comment, yes. For the first question, admit that I can't really remember that Hungarian authorities or, institutions state institutions deliberately supported public commemoration of queer history. At least they were not aware of this support. I remember. This is the great thing about a few great things about, I guess, Orbanistan, that it makes us more creative and it also increases the level of solidarity. I think these are very important things. But I remember when we wanted to erect a new tombstone grave. How do you call it?
Memorial.
Thank you. Yeah, my English is also well. Yeah. Well, anyway. So I remember when we wanted to erect this memorial for Kertbeny. Kertbeny was the person who coined the word homosexual and heterosexual, by the way, and in the same time, around the 1860s. And he was born in Vienna, and he died in Hungary. So he was one of those, you know, these Austro-Hungarian figures. And I remember several years ago, Kurt Kickler from Hosi Wien told me that, you know, why don't you look, I mean, not me, Judith, but you Hungarians, why don't you look into this, you know? I mean, he was born in Vienna, in our country, and he died in yours, in our countries. So why don't you look into this? And we went to look into it, and actually we found his grave, and we wanted to erect a memorial. Thank you again. And I remember that it was so clear for us, you know, activists, that this is something very important, that we have this memorial for this guy. But this was clearly a very, awkward moment when we went to the director of the cemetery, and she asked us, so who is this guy? Why do you want to erect a memorial? So it was clear that the grave was originally there, but we wanted to erect a new memorial, and we were not family, and you know, and he didn't have a family, listed all these titles, that he's a writer, he was a journalist, he did this and that, and at the end we also added, and by the way, he invented the word homosexual and heterosexual, because decided that this cannot be, that wanted to erect this memorial without actually making it clear for the authorities as well that this is part of the reason, and from our side, this is the main reason why we want this memorial. So this is just an example, but I think it's a nice example that you can cooperate with the authorities, but in a kind of unusual way, perhaps. And of course, we have different shadows of authoritarian governments, and also it reminds us that it must remind us that democracy is very fragile. I remember. Then in the early 2000s, I was so proud to go to conferences and tell about the great Hungarian legislation, which was the first state-level legislation which had a protection for trans people. It was in 2003. When it was introduced, and now when I go to conferences, they don't mind what I'm talking about. They just ask me about Orbán, and, you know, did you vote for him, or, you know, and things like that. And it's like, oh my God. So this is just a reflection for the first question. It's difficult. I don't know. I have some great Hungarian colleagues here, and I think we can agree probably. Well, they can tell in the question. Time, but they can comment on this. It would be great. On the other hand, you know, for the other question, there is this widespread assumption about, you know, it's better in the West than in the non-West. My comment about this, my first thing that came into my mind when I read this question was, here come again all these imposed categories, because if I ask again my Hungarian colleagues, I'm not sure that we see ourselves as East. Or, you know, I remember that with Czech colleagues we had this conversation, and also with Polish colleagues, I think, and Slovakian colleagues, and perhaps even with Croatian colleagues, that we are all Central European, yeah, from our perspective. And of course, And of course, we shouldn't forget that we are all part of the global north. I mean, whatever, so this is, it's not just the east and the west, or west and non-west, but it's, you know, the north and the south, and, you know, they are all, you know, intersections in all directions. And I would like perhaps someone who is from the West to reflect upon, you know, how is it? Is it better in the West? Why do I? So, I'm inviting you, you know, to reflect upon this, because I think that would be also very, we could learn a lot from that as well. So I think my time is up now, but we can continue this a bit later. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And now we can pass on exactly that question. I mean, or maybe we get an answer from the north. Pia, would you like to
Shall I answer? I was supposed to ask her something, and I shall... No, I don't think it's better in the West, and it depends on... I really liked your reflection, Judith, on the intersections. I mean, in each and every country, we have a North and a South. We have a great, huge differences. We have a West and a East. We have class differences. We have color differences, skin color differences. It's different to be a gay male and a lesbian. It's a queer and something in between everything. And it's different if you are a male to female trans person or a female to male trans person. So it's a lot of differences within the queer community and when it comes to a lot of different things. And I also think that it goes very much for the West, a country like Sweden, that democracy is something people have been fighting for. We need to fight for it, and we need to defend it, and we need to define it, as someone said in the Queer Archive group today. We have to define what democracy, what kind of democracy we want. And also, I think that hate and things are global. I mean, if someone, like we have a cultural heritage person, a Muslim who is in the cultural heritage board in Sweden, who has been out in debates about the hate against Muslims, and he's so hated by troll machines from Russia, from the United States, and so we have traced that. So, I mean, if you are there out and opposing and debating and demanding rights, you will be hated wherever you are. And depending on who you are, you will be hated in very different ways, and you will be able to defend yourself in very different ways also. And people are also murdered because they are queer in Sweden. So... that's why I'm saying, you know, where it's a space for oppression, there is also space for resistance. And I think that you beautifully, you know, encompass that in your talk. Thank you.
Well, speaking of North and South, we're going to move, so it's a cliche, but Aaron... You are from north of the border, where things are supposedly really nice for queers and everybody else. Does this reflect your experience setting up the transgender archives? And more universally, how do the commemoration of sexual diversity and gender diversity relate to one another?
Thank you. So north of the border, you know which border we're talking about. We're in Canada, is north of what we now know as Trump land. Gets a laugh every time, it's great. I think it's sad. I don't know why people keep laughing. So, compared to south of the border, if that's the way we're framing this, things are going quite well in Canada. As you probably know, right now the U.S. is in a bit of a frenzy celebrating the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. which took place June 28, 1969. What you probably don't know is that the day before Stonewall, Canada decriminalized homosexuality in private between consenting adults. So we often compare ourselves to the U.S. because they are very big and they do dominate our culture. But while the Americans are celebrating a huge rebellion that got things started, Canada had already passed a law that said decriminalized in private consenting adults. So keep that in mind. That law was brought in by Pierre Trudeau, who is the, for those who don't know, the father of our pretty boy prime minister who we have now. And in the Trudeau dynasty, yes. He introduced a bill into the Commons that would decriminalize homosexualities performed in private. And he told reporters, this is very famous, reported all the time in Canada, there is no place for the state in the bedrooms of the nation. And what's done in private between consenting adults doesn't concern the criminal code. It didn't pass immediately, but it did pass when he later became prime minister. He was justice minister at the time. And so we celebrate that. There's a lot of celebration going on in Canada now about that. But what is often ignored is that even before the law was passed, pretty much nobody got arrested for what they did between consenting adults in private. So it didn't really change all that much. And in fact, if you look at the police records, arrests actually kind of increased after that law was changed. So there's something to celebrate, but maybe not so much. Coming to trans people, which is the focus of what I do, the laws in Canada for trans people are generally quite good. But as I just was trying to illustrate by talking about the laws about homosexuality, laws are just a first step. They don't necessarily mean that anything changes. So laws give us an opportunity to up the ante a little bit on our activism and give us a little bit more of a lever to use in the activism. Policies, practices, public opinions, and attitudes all have to change. Behavior change must follow the changes in the laws. But the laws are quite good, and my experience of Canadians are that they're actually very invested in seeing themselves as liberal and inclusive. It's part of kind of Canadian psyche and self-image. When it comes to trans issues, most people are well-intentioned. We've even done some surveys that show this. But they're ignorant of what full implementation would really mean. There's been some good progress. The potential is good, but there's still really a lot of work to be done. So we are nice, and we're trying to be nicer. In terms of my experience with setting up the Transgender Archives, everyone was very supportive when I proposed doing the archives from the start, so long as it didn't have any major impact on their budgets. Okay, so lots of moral support, lots of support in kind as well. So the Transgender Archives, for those of you who are not aware, is actually part of the University of Victoria. And the University of Victoria has been very generous with in-kind support. So where there are people on staff, I have tremendous availability to their time and in terms of space and other sorts of supports. They've been very good. But everybody had to add that to their existing duties. So people were there, I got to use their time, but they just had to work harder in order to help with the Transgender Archives. Anything that costs money, I have to raise that money myself. All right? And so that's what the support has been like there. Moving on to the bigger question, which was, how do we commemorate, how's the commemoration of sexual diversity and gender diversity relate to one another? So, to me, I think that the public sees the whole alphabet spectrum, LGBTQ2IA++, as all part of the same rainbow, and that we, as a community, contribute to this view by using these kinds of acronyms, and even more so by the direction we're moving into by calling all of us queer. What binds us together, I think, is the degree of discrimination and abuse that we experience as a reflection of how much we offend dominant gender norms. The more obviously gender variant someone is, the more discrimination and abuse they experience. The people who have been our pioneer activists have largely been those people whose gender variance has been the most obvious, regardless of what their sexual orientation might be. Those people who are the least able to hide in a closet have, in the past and still today, take the most abuse and sacrifice the most to make room for all the rest of us. Until quite recently, our Anglo-European, Global North, however you want to slice it, societies, the ones that I have some experience of and some knowledge of, in them, most trans and gender diverse people, and in the societies colonized by those folks, most of those people have spent decades of their lives, most of the trans and gender diverse people, thinking that they were the only ones in the world like themselves. We now have a generation growing up that knows that there are others like them, but that's new. That's really new. And during those years, when they felt they were the only ones like themselves, many were exposed to and adopted the myths that lesbians were women who wanted to be men, and that myth was perpetuated by the popularity, in part perpetuated by popularity of The Well of Loneliness, who set a tone, and that gays were men who wanted to be women. And Judith caught me up on this. I was going to Kurt Benny, but that was actually Ulrich, who said, female souls trapped in male bodies. That was that phrase, which we now use to describe trans people, was originally used to describe gay men. And so a lot of people who eventually came out as trans spent a lot of time either thinking of themselves as gay and lesbian, or spent a lot of time in gay and lesbian environments, because historically that was the only place it was in the least bit safe to be gender variant, whether you were gay or not. So our histories are definitely intertwined, and today are still intertwined. In recent years, just the last few years, LGBTQ archives are starting to give a lot more attention to the T part of what they're doing and are trying to rectify that. But that's recent, and most of those archives have very little T content and have not given much attention to it until now. But people are trying now, and that's great. And one of the things that I'm seeing happening and been discussed here at this conference is that a lot of archives are now turning to calling themselves queer as a way to be more inclusive. And I want to ask you to proceed with caution as this is introduced into what we're doing, because I think it introduces a new danger, and that's the danger of obscuring or erasing trans and non-binary and two-spirit and other gender-diverse people as distinctive identities. We have very little history written yet about trans and non-binary, two-spirit and gender-diverse people, and we need archives that are specifically, or at least sections of archives, that are specifically about those communities. And there are many intersections between those communities and lesbian and gay and queer communities, and those intersections are important, and we need to pay attention to them, but not lose track of where they are different. So we need each other, and we need to celebrate both our intersections and our unique paths.
Thank you. And I'd like to ask Judith to
respond. Yes, I would like to disagree with you just in one point, and that is I'm a sociologist, so when you tell me that laws don't give us too much, I have to think about those empirical results which show that actually, at least concerning homophobia, those laws which are against homophobia, or for example those which enable people to don't feel secondary citizens, so like for example marriage equality, even if you don't want to marry or if you hate this institution, legally this gives you equal standing. But so if in those societies where you have these sort of normalizing messages sent out by the state in form of law, and law is actually I think it's really this message from the state that this is okay, this is, you know, it's just fine. So this has we can see it now in a lot of empirical results, comparative survey results. When, you know, like in last in our last study, we have compared the attitudes of 300,000 people. So that is quite a lot. And then you see that it makes a difference. So perhaps it doesn't give you everything straight away, but I think it's very important. You know, good policies good policy framework makes a great difference. And this is a big difference, for example, between Sweden and Hungary or Russia. Or, you know, we know that. I mean, those of us who live in deprived social environments in this respect, we know that this is a great difference. And for those of you who live in more advantageous social context, it's perhaps a bit taken for granted, but we learned this, that this is not exactly the case. On the other hand, I do agree with you with most of the other things you said. Well, if it matters at all. And I again just an observation about, you know, what you said about gender variance. It reminds me of again rainbow families, for example, that gender variance it means increased social visibility. It's a bit like, you know, like an individual with his or her or their sexual orientation, you can keep it invisible or it doesn't matter. But once you have a partner, you are more visible. Once you have family, you are, you know, very much more visible. And you know, when you move into somewhere, and you know, all these spatial arrangements, and when you, for example, organize a wedding party, it's very socially visible, because this whole ritual is all about that. And I guess gender variance is also, you know, because of this increased social visibility. This is why it's so much attracts attention of different from different social groups, I would say. But you wanted to react.
Just very briefly, I don't think we actually disagree. My point is only that it is a first step, and it is a very, I agree completely, laws are an extremely important first step that send a message about what we as a society approve of and don't approve of, what we encourage, what we don't encourage. But between the passing of the law and the being able to register that it has had an effect, you have to have many people taking many steps to implement those laws and make them real. So I don't think we actually disagree. It's just a matter of emphasis.
I think this is, and you are really right about this, the key word is implementation. You can have wonderful laws, but if they are not implemented, well, that's not so good.
Thank you very much, Aaron and Judith, for that interaction. The next question, and the last question on the panel before we open up the discussion to the audience, is for Katarina. Some people might say that queer activists in Russia have more important things to do at the present than to engage with the queer past and to preserve queer memories, kind of queering memories, the kind of thing we've been discussing over the last 3 days. Why would you say, or do you think it's still crucial, and why, if so, do you think it is still crucial, maybe exactly in those circumstances, to continue to preserve queer memories? And thinking about queer archives versus public or official archives, so queer kind of more grassroots archives versus public or official archives, libraries and museums, can you give us some sense of the levels of complexity involved in kind of navigating that space between the subcultural, the grassroots, and the more official, and how that plays out in your work?
Thank you very much for such difficult questions. And I would like to start with a little explanation that history plays a tremendous role in current Russian ideology, and we even have a law according to which you can be prosecuted for spreading so-called falsest facts about World War II, or we call it the Great Patriotic War. But still some citizens don't have a history, can't go to archives because they closed to it's a special section, cannot recreate the history officially. Is it even possible to create an LGBTQ public archive nowadays in Russia? And my answer is no. It's not. Because we don't even have a public discussion about queers, and above all about sexuality as it is. But you should ask me, of course, the question about anti-gay propaganda and huge media campaign around it, and yes, some quite unpleasant and violent assumption towards gay people circulate around official media, but what this law can tell us, except this sometimes frightening assumption. This law can tell, this law reinvented, I already told about this at our panel, reinvented the dichotomy of the traditional and traditional sexual relationship. What does it mean in terms of history and especially the genealogy of sexuality? Shortly, we don't have a history of traditional relationship, not because it wasn't recorded, but because it simply doesn't exist. There are no any evidence that this kind of notion exists in 19th century, 18th century, 16th century, so no traces and no documents. In the discourse of tradition, we can't imagine sexuality in terms of embodiment experience because pleasure or sex is a way of getting it. Doesn't exist in the public sphere, thereby the body as it is excluded from the normalization except directly by a political function of reproduction. So, and traditional obviously is a synonym for heteronormativity in this discourse, and the only body that traditional citizen can identify with is the body of the nation. Fascinating, isn't it? And what's about untraditional in this dichotomy? How we can even deal with this particular situation? It seems that queers don't leave official traces, it's obviously true in the current Russian culture, but have a direct connection to the body and the process of identification through the body, respectively. So they have social status of the radical other in the current Russian context because they are obviously characterized as untraditional. But what it gives us, what kind of the opportunity it gives us in terms of history and in terms of archive. So, and this dichotomy emphasizes several really important things, what even traditional means without untraditional, and what comes first. This is where the term liquid archive, which I call liquid archive, should appear, and I would briefly explain you how it works. So after the past 10 years, all the public sphere moved to your internet, and there are a lot of blogs, Telegram channels, sites, which is dedicated to queer and LGBTQ and feminist issues. And mostly all of the people publishing promote quite similar ideas, but I would like to show you one example of what I called liquid archive. So from the very I would like to talk about this site, which is a period I think a year and a half ago. It's called Ozine. And they identify themselves as online platform writing about everyday life for the Russian queer community because nobody knows that we have everyday life. Seriously, I'm seriously talking about this. Nobody knows that we go into grocery shop or behave like a human being. They don't know. They don't try to resist these old Zion guys. They don't try to resist the authoritarian traditional discourse, and mostly don't post text about human rights or any text regarding current political situation. And they do remain the other and push this very idea, manifesting the body and desire as a rooting around us. So, and thus they give an opportunity to see lots of scenarios and variations of sexuality, which are certainly untraditional, but have one quite important thing, identification for body experience. They do create a sort of queer everyday life public archive, which can be characterized as a liquid one because it can be owned. There is no official language that can possibly describe it, except the given dichotomy, which, as we remember, artificially created and has no historical basement at all. And they do open the discussion about visibility of other bodies, which is really important. And such kind of projects as like Ozyme brings back the body and identification connected to it into the public discourse. By doing so, they're challenging the official traditional discourse and the bodiless historical narrative in order to start the process of recovering repressed embodiment memories and helping, I hope, in the future to create what we can proudly call queer archive. And this is the example of it yesterday. 10,000 copies of the newspaper, which is called Kommersant Weekend, were sent around Russia with these featured materials on the cover of the paper, which is dedicated to the Stonewall and 15th anniversary of it. So, maybe you think this is something which we should be proud of it, or I don't know, it's just like basic idea. I mean, like I think in America you can find thousands of publications dedicated to this event, but let's imagine that average Russian citizen don't know that I can go to grocery shop and buy some bread for myself, and this is 10,000 copies. And this is my friend published this article, and this is how we start.
Okay, thank you very much. And now we would like to ask Jonathan to add to that, comment on that.
So I'm going to put on my cheerleader uniform now and say that 50 years ago in the United States, we were very close to where Russia is now, which is to say that we had constant violence against queer communities. We had laws that were unchallenged across the land. There was a period in my life where I think I was in jail every week. My first comment to my, whenever I called my mother, she'd say, "What prison are you in?" So these things change. And what made them change, and here I'm going to sound really banal and stupid, is coming out. I realize how incredibly difficult that is, given the social pressures. But what we did is we converted families into ambassadors. And when people who were loved told their friends, their families, that they were queer, then slowly and over time, a huge, huge shift happened. By the way, Trumpland indicates it ain't complete. And homophobia was a big part of his appeal. So we still have, in the United States, a great deal of work to do. But what I want to say is that it may not, frankly, benefit you, but those who come after you will build memorials to your memory.
Thank you very much. I'm thinking that it's not only the problem of coming out, because I told you about Ozyme. Ozyme is an open platform. You can access it wherever you want. It's not prohibited. So it's just you need to put the there is a window which is says, "Are you 18 years old?" You say yes, and then. Who? The whole world. This is how we deal with it. This is how we come out. Because seriously, it's quite important to create this liquid archive from step to step in order to present it to a huge amount of people who doesn't know how to deal with their own bodies because they don't know how to do it, because they live in the discursive, they live in the official discourse where these bodies are doesn't matter.
So we now have, maybe we could give you. Yeah. So we now have we've now got a little bit of time for questions. We thought that we'd maybe take two or three questions first, and then do them in sort of rounds of two or three questions to see. We have about 20-25 minutes, I think, for discussion before we give the speakers an opportunity to comment in response. So we'll just take questions from the audience. So first of all, I see you in the red here. Yeah, this one.
Yeah,
it's coming.
Hey. This is probably a question that is more for the panelists from the Global North or however you want to phrase it, but I want to contest a little the idea that we're, you know, so much farther ahead in so many things, because I think that queer archives have become, or however you want to call them, LGBT archives, are community spaces first and foremost, and that's a big part of what they are, and that's a big important part of what they are. But as somebody who teaches university in Germany and also teaches future teachers, I don't think anybody learns about our history that's not queer and seeks it out themselves when they're grown up. So I think my question would be, what are we going to do about educating those that are not already part of our community, and maybe also just the younger members of our community that don't feel the need to seek us out anymore because they think everything is okay?
I'll take another question. Any other questions? Up the back there. And does anyone else want to ask a question? I'll take a third one. Down here.
Thanks. Just given we're on the site of a burned library, and given the thrust of the conversation with a rightward surge in a lot of these countries, are there any like contingency plans in place or logistical considerations for evacuating collections or personnel if the worst was to happen to one of these archives or collections? Both for the library where it might collapse and also receiving libraries in countries that might consider themselves more stable.
Thank you. And Jean Dretter down here.
Okay. Yes, thank you. And mine isn't actually a question, but it's something I have not heard brought up yet that I'd kind of like to remind everybody about. And that's, there's one thing that all of us seem to do that's internalized homophobia, at least from my concept and picturing of the world. And that's when you do anything, like you had asked the young Swedish lady about, you know, big museums borrowing things from us. When they do, please make sure that they give you credit. When they borrow a painting, a vase, a paper, anything from you, make sure, and it's in a book or on a wall, whatever, make sure it says from such and such GOBT archive or whatever your archive is. You know, we all use different terms. And the second one also involves those sorts of terms. We all speak different languages. Different languages have different ideas on grammar and things like that. So let me give you the example in English. If somebody wants to quote us, borrow from us, say anything about us in a newspaper, in a paper that's written by a student, I don't care what it is, we kind of insist that they capitalize the words gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. We deserve to have an honorific as much as any other religion, any other state, any other anything that is capitalized in this world. And that internalized homophobia of us lets big museums put our stuff on display and not give us credit. And it allows all kinds of newspapers, televisions, everything to quote us and not give us an honorific at all. And so I just ask everybody, remember that the next time they ask you something and say, we are as deserving of an honorific as anybody else. Thank you.
So I'd like to invite anyone from the panel to respond to these contributions.
Thank you for calling me Jan, Swedish lady. I feel vitalized. but I was thinking of the question you asked about how to educate people who are not belonging to the community and whatever community we are belonging to. I think that there are a lot of things around now that wasn't around when I was a really young Swedish lady. And in the 60s, it's a lot of feature films, it's novels, we have the web, the internet, that is now, of course, hijacked by a lot of negative powers, but still there are a lot of possibilities to distribute feature films about queer lives or LGBT plus, and so on and so forth. And also to spread novels and research and exhibitions on the net and open access and so on and so forth. And then and one could say that, well, in certain dictatorship, they are closing down the internet. But then I would like to give you an example from the Chinese friends and colleagues we have that might not be here today, but I met them before. And they have a strong censorship against magazines. They cannot produce and distribute magazines without that censor board looking into it. So what did they do? Of course, they found a space for resistance. You can subscribe on things, small items like pencils or whatever, like a cute little duck or something like that to have in your bath tube. You can also attach a magazine to that little thing. So the lesbians, they disseminated 30,000 copies each month of their lesbian magazine, and it can, no, it reached all the corners of China. So. Yeah, so educating children and in schools. Well, you can find. I don't know. We have different curriculum. Yeah.
Curriculum.
Yeah, and but in Sweden, we have this norm critical pedagogy that we have been working with for some years, and all. Again, activists have pushed together researchers, the National Educational Board, to include this in the curriculum. So activists, we rely on activists to get things going, but we should work both on strengthening the communities, of course, but also towards all kinds of boards and authorities. I don't know if that was a good answer.
The great, friendly, nice North actually has, in many parts of the country, put in to the standard required curriculum for grade school a SOGI curriculum, sexual orientation, gender identity curriculum. So the kids are being taught this stuff, whether their parents want it or not. And there are many parents who object, and it is somewhat controversial, but the province I live in and several other provinces have introduced this as part of the standard curriculum. So people are getting educated that way. I teach at a university, and it's content in all of my classes, and this kind of thing is going on unevenly, but is going on across the country. I also wanted to just say a word about, do we have evacuation plans for our collections? University of Victoria, where the Transgender Archives is a public institution, and it has very sophisticated storage facilities. And they're prepared for floods and fires and earthquakes and all those sorts of things up until a point. And there comes a point where they call it an act of God because there's nothing any of us can do about it. So we don't have a plan to evacuate our collections, but we certainly have, because the Transgender Archives has the luxury of being in a publicly funded institution, a fairly large institution. We get 22,000 students, so it's a fairly big place. We've got pretty high quality storage for that collection. I recognize that that's an incredible privilege and that is extremely rare, but I want you to know at least one collection is pretty safe.
I just wanted to take on the question again of how we get interest in people who aren't already interested. And I want to say that at the outset that I think we have a problem. And the problem is that queers are not underrepresented in museums, in literature, in culture at large. In fact, if anything, we're overrepresented. What we are, however, is discursively underrepresented. So while we're present, our names aren't spoken, our queerness not articulated. And what we therefore have to do is a very complicated move where we say, it's not like, for example, with other communities where there's just nothing there. It is instead that we haven't been framed according to the truth, that our histories have not been articulated. And I think towards doing that, one of the greatest moves, at least we have found, and it's extremely difficult to do, is activism, which is to say that when they do an exhibition now that, for example, doesn't touch on questions of sexuality, we do exhibitions that make clear that sexuality was actually key to what they were trying to articulate. You have to keep at it. And over time, they realize that the costs of not talking about us are more than the costs of doing so.
So, shall we do a last round of questions from the audience or comments? Yes, one in the front here, and then a second one.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say thanks to LMS Conference because I think my voice is representing all the South Asian community who are not in the panel, but yes, my voice is there. So I'm really thankful that you made us possible to come here and share our best practices. We did first Transgender Pride in December 2018 in Pakistan. And and I'm the founder of the first Transgender Pride and the key person who presented the bill which has been passed, and now we have a transgender rights law. So it's a big moment of truth for me to come and share this best practice. And I know we next year when we'll come, we'll archiving these successes as well. So, you know, nothing is lost and there would be no gap. And really, this is a really wonderful experience and moments of growth when you share your best practices, then we make this moment globally strong. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marie Cartier from Los Angeles. And I just want to make two comments. One is that Please, if we could refrain from saying Trumpland, I would very much appreciate it. It's not a joke to me. We are terrified in the United States of what's happening, and the school that I teach at has one of the largest concentration of dreamers. In the United States, many of my students are afraid their family members will be deported, and what we are working with, in, especially in Southern California and other places, it's not funny, and most of us didn't vote for him. And I don't see the America at all as being owned by Trump. And Katerina, one of our large concentrations of students is Russian emigres, and we are so proud of you. And this is an astounding example of courage, and I want you to stay alive. At all. I mean, I want you to stay alive and keep doing what you're doing. And in queer studies at my school, the knowledge that there are activists doing LGBT work in Russia is incredibly empowering. You are doing work that many of us have never felt the challenge that you are doing to do. I know many of us feel the same, but I know that LGBT students who come from Russia, the fact that they know that there are some pockets of activism happening, you are a lifeline to people. And you are loved, and your work is loved. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for both these contributions. Is there... Yes, please.
Yes, thank you. I'm from Colombia. One of the things that I've seen here and sharing our thoughts with some partners from Latin America, but also from other non-European countries, is the facilities that you have on archives. I mean, to be able to say that you have a preventive measure for archive. All I was thinking was, my archive is under my bed in a small box. and the colleague from Brazil was speaking truth when he said awareness is a useful tool for this kind of situations. But I want to rebuff your question. What do you think you can do for these small archives? I mean, there are some delegates from other non-European countries in this conference, and we are grateful for it. But I'm just rebuffing your question, like, what do you think you can offer to this small archive? What is the thing that you can provide? And it's not about money, not only, at least. It's about what do you think that these academic spaces can open up from these small archives or small queer memory researches. So for anyone who is interpelled by the question, thank you very much.
If it's a quick one, I'll take one.
Very quick. I was just going to suggest that the well-founded, the well-facilitated archive north of the border could perhaps offer to maintain digital copies of the smaller archives around the world.
Okay, thank you very much. Sorry for everybody. Can we? Is it? I have something important to say. All right. If it's important, no, I'm sure it is.
Thank you, and thank you for the panel and for the whole conference. I've enjoyed it immensely, but I have to say something bitter. And I feel terribly uncomfortable because I was hoping someone better suited would say that. But since this hasn't happened, I feel like I must. For such a diverse and fascinating and intriguing and wide-reaching conference in terms of thematic and cultural content, this is a very wide panel. And we've had fantastic speakers from many, many countries, from Taiwan, from Tunisia, from Colombia, and they are not there. And I'm sure that a panel with more people from these countries would be at least as fascinating as this one. And I see this panel as a kind of a summary of the whole conference. So with this setup of, with the human setup of this panel, I feel like the voices, the very important voices of people from all over the world, and by all over the world, I don't just mean Europe and North America, I feel like they are ignored and considered less important. So I think we should work on that. So this is a something for the organizers, not just the organizers of this conference, but any future conference, to think about these matters. And also for the potential panelists of any future panel, maybe to think if what I want to say, because of course it's wonderful to sit on stage and be admired by everyone and tell great things, but maybe to consider and to think if what I have to say is really important, if there's maybe someone who has something much more important to say, and maybe talk to the organizers and ask them these questions too, and just step aside and make room for all these other incredible voices from all over the world. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was actually a very important point. So I'm glad that we had it. And you know, now kind of it's the last round of last words. And you
would
see.
Would you like to respond to that from the steering committee? I can say something from the.
I thought I would have more time to think about it, but.
I also would like a little moment to think about it, but.
If we kind of maybe ask you first to respond to the different variety of
well,
points.
Well, I mean, I can go
made.
Ahead. It's a direct question, so I can go ahead and respond if you think.
Okay, then, you know what we do. We start with Kate, then we go this way around, and then, all right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to say thank you for the contribution. I think that it's a really, really important thing. I think that it's clearly the history of the, as we know, it constantly comes up as a theme that even the idea of having a social movement that can give rise to a generation of historians or people who have a historical consciousness who begin to collect things and have the resources to collect them. They have beds under which they can put boxes. They begin collecting boxes, then they begin applying for funding. They eventually grow and grow and grow to things like my experiences from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. It started as a box under a bed. It eventually graduated to a few boxes in the side room off the side of a car garage where the rubbish bins were kept. That's where it was for many, many years. Eventually, more and more funding was gathered. This is the trajectory that these organisations can take in countries like Australia. Many countries around the world do not have this opportunity. So I think that it's one of the reasons why we organised the conference program the way that we did and worked so hard to get to really have a global focus and to really reduce the white dominance. It is going to be white dominated still in 2019. But we tried so hard to reduce that as much as possible. But the context is that if you are having a conference of queer archives, you have a conference of queer archives that exist. And we even had, that's why we accepted contributions and put speakers on the panel who come from contexts where there are no queer archives. Valentina Iescu, for example, from Iancu, from Romania, gave a paper about an archive that exists. She had a dream about it. She had a dream about an archive in Romania. So we put that on the conference program because we recognised that we needed to actually include these stories in the conference program. I think it's an absolutely fair enough criticism of the panel this evening. This panel was put together 4 or 5 months ago. We had the contributions that came in as submissions, in order to
de-whitify the conference. We did accept papers that came in later from people who are from other contexts. So there has been a dynamic process. But this panel was put together specifically to try and really get at that theme of the you know, representatives of these strongman governments to try and get the conversation going between the global north and the global south. But I do think we can always do better. And I think that I'm so glad that you felt confident enough to actually raise your hand and make that point. And I think that's something that for me, and as part of the organising team, I feel really, really proud that this criticism can even be spoken in the space. And I think that this is the conversation that we want to actually keep having. And I really thank you for that.
The last words. So I think for me and for my neighbor Latin America, it's really important to be here because we can take a contact, we can take a network, and we think it's would be so fantastic to organize a queer Latino conference like that. And I think it's a really, really important to think that Latinos, Africans, Asians goes to by far to be here, and so difficult to be here. For me, it's a really, really difficult to be here because I am from Brazil. I don't have a lot of money, a lot with a lot of my country. So it's really important to be here. It's really important to the AMIS organization see these persons and see the difficulty to these persons to be here. And I think one thing is very important for us. We think to accessibility. And I think it's really, really important in the next AMS conference has to accessibility to Spanish speakers, to Portuguese speakers as a translators, because it's so very difficult to be here and to talk in English you that doesn't have your national language. So please, sorry for my confused, but really, really important to us to be here, to a Latin American be here, to make these networks and to take this for us and to take this in our neighbor to have maybe one conference in queer Latin America in the next period. Thank you.
You know, it's really good feeling when you actually starting to feel that you are really existing in the condition and the orientation or any kind of the gender that you prefer. So thank you very much for this kind of the feeling. And we will continue to dig into documents and histories and to reveal all these ideas into publics in order to create a safe place in Russia. And I'm still pretty sure that we don't need any 50 years in order to create some kind of the at least gender, kind of the gender equality that we doesn't have right now in our country. So thank you very much.
Okay, I don't know if you do critique over there, you criticize her over there. We're here when I was speaking, but I raised similar considerations about whiteness and the Global North participants there. But I would like to
as my final word, say something about funding. I mean, all of us needs funding to be able to attend the conference, but also to realize our different projects. And we have long been using the Human Rights Declaration to argue for the relevance of inclusion. And now the and people in Europe and Eastern Europe that are members in EU has used EU declarations to pursue sexual rights and so on and so forth, and to get funding. But another argument I would like to lift a little bit now is that is those global development goals that UN are pursuing right now. You know, global development goals for sustainability. And I think that funders now are being increasingly sensitive to those goals. So look them up and use inclusion of marginalized groups as of importance for social sustainability, because many of these development goals are about social sustainability as well. So we can move into those areas to get fundings. So look them up and use them wherever you are. Thank you.
I would like to thank all of you for being the inspiration that you are. The work that I do, that we do, that I have been doing for many decades, it's slow, it takes a long time, and it is heartening and encouraging to see so many other people, to meet so many other people, to hear from people who are fighting tremendous odds, much bigger than I have to fight, that we have to fight in my part of the world, and to take inspiration from you. So I thank everybody for a fantastic conference, and I look forward to the ones in the future that will be even better.
Well, on a very practical note, I think it's a very good idea to have some more globalized conferences and some more regional ones. What you said, that you had so many applications, it shows the interest and increasing interest, and hopefully this will continue this interest. And also I just, I hope that we can still have an arms conference in our life in St. Petersburg. Perhaps, hopefully.
I just have two practical proposals that I wanted to raise. One would be whether one of our goals as an organization would be to go to a gigantic international corporation like Google and say, look, we have these archives. It's time for this to be scanned and made available. They do this, they've been doing this for books. Why can't they do it for our archives? And if we put enough pressure on them, especially now when they're coming under a lot of critique, they may see this as politically a viable way of moving. So I would encourage us to think seriously about writing a well-developed proposal to a place like Google and get them to fund what we need. Why no? They wouldn't own the content. Okay. Second proposal. Maybe a little bit more popular. And this is a genuine quandary that I find myself in, so it's a genuine question. Would it be beneficial at this point in our organizational development to consider breaking out as well museums and on a irregular basis asking the museum groups to meet separately, because some of the questions that museums face are different questions. There are lots of points of overlap. No? Okay. I would like what? That's right, three. I would just like to raise this as something that we should be at least discussing, because I do think that questions specifically around whether it is beneficial to have queer museums as opposed to queering mainstream museums are, you know, quite relevant questions.
I think it's a great... And I've been to a panel this afternoon where these options have been discussed, and I think there is a lot still to do. You mentioned the word solidarity in the very beginning, but it's not about mentioning the word. It's about doing it and finding ways to work against those asymmetries and those... well, basically, it is also about funds and money and finding ways to transfer those to where they are needed. I absolutely agree. And I also, I'm very grateful for the time I now had to think what I can say as the last guy who has the last word, which is also very strange. And I'm also, you know, I mean, in terms of politics of representation, this is all wrong. But I was going to still wanted to say that in terms of the organizing committee, the steering committee, we discussed these questions very early on as questions. We realized too late that it's not only about topics and what diversity of topics are covered in the conference, but it's also about who are the people who are visible. And to be honest, one of the reasons why it's so difficult for me to react to that point is that I was sitting here during the panel and I thought, like, as one of the people who organized this panel, I thought, like, oh. And obviously, you know, we should have done better there. We actually quite seriously thought about what we will pass on to the next organizers, because we have ideas organizationally. We already talking about funding and enabling people to come. We already did quite a bit to enable not everybody who wanted to come, but to find funding for people who come from kind of situations where it's difficult to fund the travel to Berlin. We did what we could to get those funds and to make them accessible. I'm sure that the next organizers of the next ARMS conference can do more. I hope they can. But it is definitely one of the main points, the visibility and the very pragmatic questions around funds that we wanted to pass on to kind of our successors. So as we have learned from the people who organized the conferences that came before this one, we hope that the people who organize the following conferences will learn from us and from this discussion as well. But I wanted to end by, having discussed the problematics of how the panel was composed. I really wanted to end by saying I think we had a fantastic discussion. We covered a broad array of topics and questions, different strategies facing and fighting oppression and difficult situations. There was actually more disagreement between the different speakers, or shall we say this also was the beginning of a discussion. Let's put it that way. Fragile democracies, mistaken securities. There's a couple of threats now on this table, across this room, and I think I look forward to following up on these threats in the next and forthcoming arms conferences. And with that, I would hand over to Kate to start kind of the closing ceremonies.
Well, actually, I would prefer first to say thank you to our panel members. Keeping in mind the criticisms that were raised, I think it's a really, it's a tough gig to get up at the end of a three-day conference and be the people who, need to say a few words to sort of wrap it up and provide some perspectives for the future. So I really appreciate your willingness to actually be part of this. I would like to hand over to Katja Korblitz from the steering committee.
So as part of the steering committee, I would ask every member of the steering committee to come up here. And I want to add that in the print of our program, there were two mistakes. We missed to put the name of two members of the steering committee, Sambura Mama Manumash Band and Hannes Hacke, who did really great work. So, and we will organize that this will be in the online version so that they will be also remembered in a queering memory. So
may I just say something in
yes?
between? On the topic of forgotten things?
Yes. Other topic, okay. So added.
The ALMS, there was an ALMS conference that took place at the June Mazer Archive in West Hollywood, California in 2011, and this was also omitted from the program, and we apologise for this to the June Mazer representatives. Thank you very much for bringing this to our attention.
Okay. So, now and I want that, Chan, would you come here and speak? Yes. Here you are.
Is it this microphone?
Is this microphone on?
Doesn't matter, I'll have that microphone.
It's on.
Yes, you can use this.
Okay,
one.
So
I will point it at myself. Okay, my role at this moment in time is a very privileged role, and that is to lead on the beginning of the thanks. Although there have been thanks, but there'll be more thanks now. What I would like to say, as someone who's been involved in the effort of planning and constructing a highly complex conference with a huge range of speakers of high quality, and to create an atmosphere where open, frank, direct questions can be asked and proposed confidently, I think that's a huge achievement on the part of this group of people. So I'd like to start there.
And we would ask the member of the organization team to come here on the podium.
So you want them all up at
yes.
once? All of them?
Yes. Esther Paul,
Andreas Pretzel, Ralf Dose, just come here.
Come on.
Come on.
Come on up.
Be not afraid. Be not afraid.
Christiani, where are you? Come on.
Is someone hiding?
Yes. Christiane is hiding here.
Stop hiding.
I've seen you. Come on.
Yes, you got a big one. I can still see you.
So, okay.
Okay, I'm going to take it away. I've been given a wonderful set of information here, and it makes everyone sound like a superhero, and I think you should have all been in costume, and I'm very disappointed that you're not, in your capes and your underpants over your tights or whatever. But here they are. So, firstly, I'd like to start by thanking the programme coordinator and strong woman, Kate Davison. Okay. As you know, Kate has communicated with you. She's worked with the steering committee. This steering committee, along with Kate, have read around 400 papers. That is a great challenge. And have reworked this programme 10 times or more to make it fit. And she's also done lots of editing. Fantastic. There you go. We'd also like to thank Ezra Paul-Avken, who cared for all the technical equipment, which sounds sort of really interesting and technical. but really, crucially, has created the website, the social media design, and has been responsible for all the questions concerning participation and registration, and night after night has prepared the programme for final print, carefully looking for every mistake. Yeah. You are the magician of media coordination and an anchor in calming this team down. I've seen other photographs, so brilliant. Okay. The venue coordinator, Sophie Richter, provided support for all the participants beforehand, concerning visa support, accommodation and sponsoring. And together with Sibylla Kerlisch of the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, there goes the strong woman, Kate Davison. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, someone's hiding at the back.
Sophie is there.
Who could it be? It's Sophie! And Sibylla. Well, no hiding place. Okay, so Sophie and Sibylla. Together they've enabled the organisation of the artistic performances in this building, the coordination of the ideas, and actually just sort of helped this conference fulfil those interesting ideas. The logistics whiz people. Shy. I'd also like to thank Ralph Dozer, who made the Arms Conference possible in the first place. In the name of the Magnus Hirschfeld Gesellschaft, he wrote a successful funding application and is now responsible for all issues regarding the finances. that's huge. But especially... Financial applause there. But especially sponsorship from the Lotto Stiftung and Hauptstadt Kulturfonds. I hope my accent's improved. That's quite good for me. Okay. Apparently you are modest and calm. And you are the most reliable banker a team could have wished for. There you go. As conference manager, Andreas Pretzel made the vision. Carry on. Made the vision of the Arms Conference Berlin become reality, and was responsible for establishing successful communication with all the partners. It says here that you flattered the sponsors. Who knows? I think charmed them, possibly. But actually spent the money simultaneously for all the needs of the conference. So I think that's great juggling work. You arranged the meetings of the steering committee. You presented a lot of problems that were unexpected, but at the same time offered solutions. That's okay, too. You always held the reins, and you acted as the ominous grise, the grey thing that's everywhere. I think that's quite spooky. But you've been passionate, encouraging, full of belief about this wonderful event, and you have spread that enthusiasm to this team and to all the people who've participated in this week. Thank you. But I have to say, earlier today, I was given the inevitable extended list of people to thank, and it's really important because no conference in the world exists. Are you ready? You're like a coiled spring. All right. I'm laughing now. So, but no conference can really function without its interns, its volunteers, and the people give of their time. So generously. So we have thanks for Christiani, Raul, and
Raul.
Oh, they're all hiding at the. And Kiernan. Is Kiernan here?
Kiernan.
Never mind. I'll have his. All right, okay. So, Kiernan, thank you very much. But also, don't clap yet. We need to get to the end. So, there are a number of other volunteers. So, Chris, Isi, Kamal, Lily, Lena, Maria, Cueva, John, and the San Diego Friends. I don't know what that means. Alice, Merla, Nat, Rubens, Rosanna, Manfred and Stephanie. What fabulous volunteers you've been. Come on up. If you're there, come on up. Are they coming up? Get them to stand up.
If you don't want to come up to the stage, that's okay, but at least stand up so we can give you a round of applause.
Yes. Yay! So it's been a privilege being part of the grandeur of the closing ceremony, as you described it earlier. I'm going to hand over to Andreas, who's going to continue with the thanks, I believe. Are you?
Here's a sign that there is also you want to thank and give something. I give you the microphone.
Oh,
thank you. Wir haben heute viel Bitterliches über Russland erzählt. Aber wir möchten das Moskauer, das russische Bitterliche ein bisschen versüßen. Ja? Und das ist unser süßer Gruß aus Moskau für das ganze Team. Ihr könnt das beim Tee trinken genießen. Wir bedanken uns bei Ihnen für die Einladung, für so eine tolle Verpflegung, für so viel Verständnis, für diese Atmosphäre. Das ist ein großes Glück und Freude für uns und ein großes Geschenk von euch. Also alles, alles Liebe.
Thank you very much.
So in fact we have Ralph Dozer.
There you go.
Thank you. Yeah, on behalf of the Magnus Hirschfeld Society, as we have been the employer of this fantastic organizational group, I have to extend a thanks of the Magnus Hirschfeld Society to the organizational team. And, well, I have some flowers, but I did not expect Sophie to be back. She made it. That's great. But I only have three flowers, not four.
Last words. We hope that this conference was an inspiring event for you, and maybe you can take away something of the spirit of the Arms Conference home, and maybe it encouraged you when you are back home in your archive, in your library, in your museum, and you feel alone. Then think of this Arms Conference. Maybe it encouraged you. If you get this spirit, we have fulfilled our mission and vision. Thanks a lot.
I would like every single member of the steering committee who is in this room to come up on the stage, because it wasn't just the organizing team who read the 400 abstracts. It was the steering committee that went through a very, very rigorous process of reading these, and they did so much work to help us coordinate the conference. So please come up. Please come up on the stage. Where are you all? Okay, well, I just wanted them to come up on the stage so they get thanks too, so thank you. And I guess the only thing left to say is that I really hope the bar is still open. It's open. So everyone that I did not get to meet, you know, I'm going to be out there having at least one or two beers. Please come and say hello.
And at the bar there will be Olga Sievers. She's the representative of this HKW. She stands over there, and you can invite her for a champagne, for instance.